Okay. I was told to come up with some difficult commands. And what I thought about was respect on the job. When you're away from your Christian brothers and sisters, and you're by yourself, what is going to distinguish you from your coworkers who are in the world? And I wanted to look at Ephesians chapter 4. Starting with verse 17. This I say, therefore, and testify in the Lord, that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk, in the futility of their mind, having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God, because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the blindness of their hearts, who, being past feeling, have given themselves over to lewdness, to work all uncleanliness with greediness. But you have not so learned Christ, if indeed you have heard him and have been taught by him, as the truth in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, that you put on the new man, which is created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. So a lot of us, well, tomorrow we have a holiday for most of us. But Tuesday, a lot of us are going to be heading back to our work with a lot of pressures. In the culture in which a lot of us work, I think about our jobs. We're going to be working next to people that may not believe in God. And if you look at the New Testament, and a lot of people had different jobs. The Lord was a carpenter. Paul was a tent maker. Peter and Andrew were a fisherman. Demetrius was a silversmith. Lydia was a seller of purple. And in the book of Ephesus, that the Christians, which was a Gentile church. So what Paul is trying to do to their conscience is to live and to train them. And it's not easy, because the culture which they lived even in the first century was full of sin and vice and corruption. And it had been so wicked. In John 17, the prayer that Jesus prays, he says, I pray that you don't take them out of the world. I don't want you to do that, but I want you to keep from the evil. And that is applicable for what we're talking about tonight, about being a Christian on the job. What impresses me about this passage is that it's so simple. I mean, how to be distinctive as a Christian on the job. Someone sees you, and they go, he's different, she's different. I wonder what religion she is. I need to talk to them about her. So Paul is describing the opposite of the Christian principles. In verse 17 of Ephesians chapter 4, he says, this I say, therefore, in testifying the Lord, that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk, in the futility of their mind. They don't get it. They don't understand it. Having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God. What a horrible thing to say about someone. Being alienated from the life of God. How would you like for someone to say that about you? Or even be on your grave marker, alienated from the life of God. That would be horrible. So, he says that it's not really uncommon for other people to be acting like that. And there's real darkness in the world. And as Christians, we need to let our light shine. distinguishing Christians on the job. So a lot of us are going back to work. And we're going to have to work next to people that have worldly qualities. And we need to be that light that shines so they can see Christ living within us. And we need to be a good example. In verse 25 of Ephesians, he says, therefore, put away lying, that each of one of you speak truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Always tell the truth. If you want to know the blackness of lying, and remember that it's always dark. Lying is always dark. Sometimes we tell a lie to get out of trouble, because it's easy. And you don't really realize the darkness and the hurtfulness of lying until someone you know, someone you trust, tells a lie to you, and that it matters a great deal and it hurts you deeply. So let's always tell the truth. Sometimes if you want to be successful in your job and you want to sell a product, you have to lie. I remember my first 12 years I lived in Michigan, and I was sick every winter. Every winter I'd be in the hospital in an oxygen tank because of my asthma. The doctor said, you got to get him out of Michigan, he's going to die. So we moved to California, and my dad was teaching at Fresno State. But the job he took was only temporary, and the guy that took a leave of absence came back, and my dad didn't have a job. So he tried different things. There was a member of the church that was a used car salesman. I think you know where this is going. And he had to lie to sell a car, and he wouldn't do it. He was a great example to me for that. And going further down here, it says in verse 26, be angry and do not sin, and do not let the sun go down on your wrath. I don't know if you remember this, when restaurants, they used to have a smoking section and a non-smoking section. I know it's the story is very extreme, but I just can't forget it. It was so horrific. There was this lady, and she was a smoker, and she kept moving over into the non-smoking section, and the people that were in there that were eating didn't like that. They were coughing, and they complained to the manager about this woman that wouldn't stay in the smoking section. And so she got angry, and she went out to her car, got a shotgun, came back in and killed one of the people in there. And as Christians, it's not wrong to be angry, but it's very dangerous when we are. And it's almost, because a lot of times when you're angry, you're going to say and do things you wouldn't normally say and do. So it's very dangerous to be angry. So in here it says, be angry and sin not. And the next one, it says, let him labor. Well, verse 28 says, let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may have something to give to him who is in need. Now, if you steal, and like sometimes people take stuff home from the job because it's easy to take, no one's going to know it. And it doesn't say just steal less. It says do not do it anymore. So let's not steal. No lying, no stealing, and corrupt talk. It says in verse 29, let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. The word corrupt here, in the Greek, it means putrid, putrid talk. Don't let your mouth have putrid talk. And it's the idea of vegetables rotting or animal meat rotting. Do you know anybody that talks like that? As Christians, we shouldn't talk like that. Our speech should be pure and edifying. So as we are on the job, let's have a good example. So people know that we're different. Remember one time as a Christian, does people know that you're a Christian? Or do you actually have to tell them, hey, I'm a Christian, I go to church? Really? I didn't know. Well, you act just like me. So let's be different. Let's be peculiar people. Remember, we're just pilgrims passing through. And let the light of Jesus shine through us. Amen?
Amen.
Amen.
Seems to contradict nearly everything else in the Bible. But we have to take a closer look at what Jesus is saying here. Other verses will tell us that we have to honor our father and mother, that we have to love our children and train them up, that we have to regard our spouse in the way that the church regards God or the way that God regards the church. So, let's get down to verse 33. Jesus makes analogies to a man building a tower and a king going to war. In verse 33, he says, so likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. Now, a lot of people have interpreted this passage, this commandment, to mean that the love with which you love God is to be so strong that the love with which you love your family and relations looks like hate in comparison. But that's way too simple. And as I read Proverbs very much, I'm not very keen on simplicity. So I believe what Jesus is saying here is not to hate the people in your life as people, but rather what we make them to be. As human beings, we don't see things as they actually are. Sometimes we'll set people up as idols. That could be a leader, that could be a mother, a father, even a loved one. hand. This actually becomes very strong when we're away from this person for an extended period of time. That's what we have to hate, is making other people into false gods. When we do that, we give ourselves over to a slavery that separates us from God. Our familiar ties, they will separate us from God by placing heritage or lineage equal to Him. Spouses can also separate us from God. Read 1 Corinthians 7. Now, as for children, I don't know how they separate us from the love of God. But I would hope that everyone who does have children knows this. When they come to know it, so you know. In essence, you have to see everyone, including yourself, as being inherently flawed, in need of saving grace, just in general. This brings me to an idea which I've seen in the church and in every denomination which claims itself to be Christian, in which we will evangelize based off of some utility you get by being a Christian. Come to church because you could be part of a community. Come to church because you receive help, or you'll have a foundation of beliefs. Instead, what we ought to be emphasizing are things like the Lord's Supper, things like singing, things like giving up what we think are important. Having communion with God, serving God, this morning I was listening to a podcast. Much of it wasn't very good. But the last thing this man said, he said that there's an idea of using brain dead women to carry out pregnancies in order to save some woman suffering. Now, there are all sorts of problems with this, as I'm sure you've already realized. Consent being one of them. But I'd rather you focus our conversation about this on what it might do to our relationships. We think that if we use something in a certain way, that if we make it more beneficial to ourselves in this present life, it'll give us some closer spiritual connection to God. Nothing could be further from the truth. And that there, trying to alleviate ourselves of some essential pain that we must go through, if we are to follow God, is one of the chief things we have to look out for. And so, we do have to love our mothers. We do have to love fathers. We cannot elevate them to the position of God. male spouses, more children.
Page 1 of 12, so I'm just kidding. Jim told me I would have to talk for a long time, but he actually kept his a little bit longer, so I have to keep it shorter. Anyway, we appreciate everybody's attention, and it's hard to push through 3, so if you're sleepy like I was this afternoon, just go ahead and nod off. I'll be all right. So this topic is about choosing hard commandments. And that's kind of a hard thing to do, because there's a lot of good, hard ones that we can choose from. When we look overall at the Law of Moses, 613 commandments, thou shalt and thou shalt not. And Jesus boiled those down to 2. And both of those 2 are laws of self-denial. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is like unto it, you should love your neighbor as yourself. And so that's what I want to focus our remaining minutes on this evening. We are called by Jesus to love the Lord our God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. And if we do that, there's not much left for ourselves. And so the call is really to love God more than we love ourselves. And Jesus says that we must love our neighbor as we love ourselves. So again, the call to self-denial is clearly evident in both of those commands. This comes from Deuteronomy chapter 6, where Moses is repeating the laws to the people of Israel. And he says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one." And we're familiar with that verse. Probably most Jews are more familiar with that verse than any of us, because they repeat it in almost every synagogue and every bar mitzvah, every Jewish celebration, more than perhaps any other Old Testament verse. There's a philosopher from the 1800s, Henry David Thoreau. He is often quoted as having said, "Most men lead lives of quiet desperation and go to the grave with the song still in them." I've always loved that quote, because he focuses in specifically on men and how we struggle with this internal battle, as men have all kinds of internal battles and struggles that we deal with. And many of us just lead those lives quietly, and many of us take those struggles to the grave. They're unresolved, even at the point of death. When we think of this concept of struggling, this internal struggle that we have within ourselves, it is actually foundational to the entire story of the nation of Israel. When we look at the story of Jacob, for example, Jacob, as he has left his family because of what he has done with his brother Esau, and goes away to Haran for many years, and he's on his way back to the promised land, an angel of the Lord comes and wrestles with him. And the angel of the Lord tells him, "You have struggled with God and man, and you have prevailed." And at that moment, he changes Jacob's name eternally to Yisrael in Hebrew, meaning to struggle with God. And that becomes, of course, the name for the nation. A symbol of not only man's struggle with man, but man's struggle with God. And it represents, in some small sense, or perhaps a greater sense, the struggle that we all have between ourselves and God. Paul talks about this as well in his letter to the Romans, where he describes his internal battle, his internal struggle with evil. in Romans chapter 7. He says that evil is present in me. And he explains how difficult it is for him to, he knows the right thing to do, yet that which is in him is struggling and trying to defy that which he knows he should do. This call to self-denial that Jesus makes to us is not only about the struggles that we have in life, that's certainly an element within that, but it is a call to give up that which we love the most. We need to perhaps think again about what Jesus said. This is the language that Jesus used when he called us to come after him and deny ourselves. If anyone wants to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. We see the desire that Jesus presents. If you truly want to live after me, if you truly want to follow me, then you must deny yourself, then take up your cross, and follow me. The problem is that in the first century, before Jesus died, the concept of a cross meant nothing other than one single thing: the road to death. It's not until Jesus is buried and resurrected that the cross becomes an eternal symbol of self-denial and of hope and of resurrection. But when Jesus called his followers to take up their cross, he was calling them to a call of death. I'm sure that those disciples, as they were casting their nets and mending their nets when Jesus called them, that they never thought how exciting the life would be to be a disciple of Jesus, sleeping on rocks and in holes in the ground and in places that were extremely uncomfortable. And we know the end of many of those disciples and apostles in the first century was torture, and many of them were dead. Peter having been crucified, apparently upside down, in the city of Rome. So what does self-denial look like? It's easy to say, take up your cross and follow me, but it's much harder to live the day in and the day out. One element of self-denial is perhaps better understanding the teaching of Deuteronomy 6, that God loved us first. And all that God is calling us to do is to return the love which he has given to us first of all. In that call in Deuteronomy 6, God calls on Moses and those generations of Israelites to remind their children simply that they will not forget all of the things that the Lord has done for them. That doesn't seem like too much of a request to make upon all future generations to remember the things that the Lord has done for us. Simply remembering that the Lord has loved us first. Of course, Paul mentions this as well in Romans 5, that while we were yet sinners, God loved us and sacrificed his Son for us. This element of self-denial is perhaps so difficult that Jesus said we actually need to seek first the kingdom of heaven. We have to really have an active pursuit of that kingdom for it to really do something. There's a story that Jesus tells in Luke chapter 12 about a man who built bigger barns. He said, boy, I've got these, let me build some more. And the entire story of that parable was that not only had the man completely forgotten about God, but God was completely interested in that man. That man forgot about his relationship with God, but God had not forgotten about him. And at the very end of that parable, Jesus says, sell your possessions and give to charity. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. It's so easy to say, take up your cross and follow me. but it's so much more difficult to do. Perhaps self-denial means different things at different stages of our life. When I was single, I was only interested in things that would benefit me. But as a parent, the most important thing for me right now is time. Time with my family, time with my children. Those are the things that will never come back to me. Those are things that I could never recover from financially. If I lost money back, I would consider it a loss. But if I lost time with my family, it would be something completely different. For Hannah, we all remember the story of Hannah. What she wanted most was a child. And at different stages in her life, self-denial meant something different. When Samuel was born, self-denial meant for her the anticipation of giving up Samuel as a young boy to the service of the Lord. I can only imagine if she had anticipated that which she had loved the most and giving it up to the Lord. And then when she took Samuel to Eli to be in the house of the Lord, that also was a moment of self-denial. And then after she gave him up, she had to live every day a day of self-denial, knowing that she had given up that which she loved the most. Abraham took a knife to that which he loved the most, his son Isaac. But what's interesting in this story of Abraham and his sacrifice of Isaac is not only that Abraham gives up that which he loves the most, but we also see buried deep in this story of self-denial is the story of resurrection. Abraham took a knife to that which he loved the most, and immediately God restored life back to him. Remember and listen again to what Jesus says. He who loses his life for my sake will find it. This is the joy of the message of the gospel. Then you give up your life and you find new life. And perhaps we are so quick to tell new Christians how they need to lose the old man, and perhaps we need to be more helpful in transitioning them to finding that new life. Whoever gives up his life for my sake will find it. The lost coin is returned to the owner, the lost sheep is returned to the shepherd, and the lost son is returned to the father. Of course, all of these stories are woven into the story that Jesus tells in Luke 15, that the lost has been recovered. New life is found. And perhaps one of the greatest stories is the story of Zacchaeus. At the moment that Jesus tells Zacchaeus that he's coming to his house, Zacchaeus says, I will give up half of my possessions to the poor. Self-denial. And his joy is not lost in his self-denial. The joy is that he now has new life in Jesus. And that is so much more valuable to him than the life that he had before of self-gain. Many years ago, when I was traveling, I went with Monica to many churches down in Columbia. And I always remember these two stories. They stand in contrast to one another. We were walking up into the mountains. There was a person that wanted to be baptized. And as we were walking along this road, there was a lot of poor people in the area. And if you've never been to South America, it's kind of hard to fully describe how that looks. But there was a house that we walked by, and their door was basically a blanket that was hung up on a piece of wood. So they didn't have enough money for a door. And so I saw a little crack there and just, you know, being interested, I just had to peek inside. And I saw a bunch of kids gathered around, and they had a big flat screen TV and an Xbox.
And I thought, man, what a weird situation. That they can't afford a door, but they have an Xbox and a TV, and that's what's important. And then the other story is a lady from another church there in Bay. And she had had all the Christians together to come and have a big dinner together. She had so little in her own house. And when we walked in, she had a small sofa and a little table. And again, I just looked around. And I went to her bedroom and I saw a bed and a little table with a Bible. I never felt so ashamed for all the vain things that I want in life, all the silly and foolish things that I desire. And this woman was so happy to share what was something so small for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. The story of self-denial is one that each one of us take as we listen to the cross of Christ, to the message of the cross of Christ. And we appreciate that Jesus calls us to do exactly what he has done for us, no less and no more, that we would deny ourselves and come to him and surrender all ourselves to him. In just a moment, we're going to sing that song of invitation. If you're not a Christian, we'd like to invite you to do that as we stand and sing.